Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. On this week's show, author Adrian Miller takes us along on an American adventure in search of true soul food. Then, our travels continue as we visit the Amazon with ethnobotanist Dr. Mark Plotkin, who explains how different our Creole cuisine would be without ingredients that come from the very endangered rainforest. We're exploring our culinary roots north and south of the border on this week's Louisiana Eats. Adrian Miller is an attorney and a certified barbecue judge who resides in Denver, Colorado. And he's also the author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine. Adrian, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Let's begin. Why don't you tell us how you define soul food?
So there's two layers to this. So first, I say soul food is the national cuisine of African Americans and one of the traditional foods of African Americans, because African Americans have made contributions to several cuisines: Chesapeake Bay Area, the Lowcountry of the Carolinas and Georgia, and also Creole cuisine, you know, lower Mississippi Valley.
Absolutely.
But soul food is really the interior South, the Deep South, the Black Belt, those foods that leave the South as Black migrants settle across the country. So what I define as the interior South, the Black Belt, is starting in the western part of the Virginias and then Carolinas, and then this broad swath of land going through Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, into Arkansas, parts of Louisiana, and then ending up in East Texas. And it's really where cotton was grown.
Ah.
And it was the highest concentration of enslaved African Americans pre-Civil War. And even after that, the highest population was pretty much in that area. And so when economic opportunities open up in the 20th century and people leave that part, most people left that part of the South for other parts of the country,
bringing their soul food with them.
Correct.
At what point did your interest in that special kind of American food begin?
All right. So I know when people hear I'm from Denver, Colorado, I lose street cred. So let me bring you back. I've got two Southern parents.
Okay.
So my mom's from Chattanooga, Tennessee. My dad is from Helena, Arkansas. So I grew up eating soul food. And the strongest expression of it was really for Thanksgiving, because we would have the turkey with the Southern sides, and then New Year's Day. So I'm going to admit on air that I eat chitlins. Only twice a year, Thanksgiving and New Year's. But then we would have black eyed peas for good luck, greens for the folding money, candy jams, cornbread. And then for dessert, we would have lemon icebox pie. That was our kind of favorite New Year's Day dessert.
Yum. For those people who maybe know the term, but they've never seen it, it's not something you see in restaurants. And I can tell from the way that you're talking about it, somehow chitlins is like a defining dish. So tell us about chitlins and why it's so important for you to claim yourself as a chitlin eater.
Yeah, so I think chitlins is the iconic soul food dish, because often there's a lot of confusion between Southern and soul. And I think chitlins is a line of demarcation. There's nobody on the fence about chitlins. Have you ever heard anybody say, oh, you know, I could take or leave chitlins?
No.
No, they either love it or hate it, right?
Uh-huh.
I'm on the love side.
And many people are just like so horrified by the concept, because explain what it is.
So it's pig intestines, and you pretty much make them one of two ways. You either stew them, and that's the way I'm used to. I've never had them fried, but fried is the other way they're done. And besides, they're horrified about what it is, they're horrified by the smell. I think that's a lot of reasons why people don't eat chitlins. But I think chitlins also plays into this idea that soul food, at its origins, is the master's leftovers.
Mm-hmm.
And what I try to do in this book is show, well, no, it's got a really high-class pedigree. And it used to be an aristocratic dish for the English and the French back in the Middle Ages on. And I show stories in the book about where you had whites eating a lot of chitlins too. But I think over time, as whites disavowed chitlin eatings, it's something that still stayed within African-American culture. And I think chitlins are the sweetbreads of soul.
That's a great way to look at it. I think we could see it on menus if it was defined that way.
Yeah.
What are the true distinctions between Southern food and soul food?
Yeah, so this is one of the most frequent questions I get. So there's a lot of confusion between the two cuisines, because there's a lot of overlap, a lot of common ingredients and techniques. I think of soul food as being more intense than Southern food and a limited repertoire of Southern food. So to me, there's a stronger emphasis on variety meats. So the neck bones, the oxtails, you know, chitlins, that kind of thing. I think there's more intense flavoring. So I think soul food tends to be spicier. So more use of cayenne pepper, maybe more sugar, more pork fat, other things. A lot of that is because of the foods that were used, right? The poverty foods that needed to be spiced up. But I think Southern food tends to be more subtle in its flavoring. And then outside the South, which I think soul food, again, is a national cuisine, you find that only certain things are really known compared to the bounty that you have in the South. So I'll give you two examples. Peas. Black-eyed peas are the ones that are iconic around the country because as people moved outside the South and wanted those foods, black-eyed peas was the one that didn't spoil as often as the other peas. So it was great for the emerging industrial commodity chain. Also in greens, collards is kind of the iconic Southern green. But, you know, in terms of soul food, I think turnip greens, mustard greens, kale, and cabbage are also popular. But you all are eating cress, poke salad, all these other delicate greens that, again, could not be shipped to other parts of the country. So I think that's why soul food is a limited repertoire.
So I read the John Edgerton's 1993 book, Southern Food at Home on the Road in History, piqued your soul food interest even further. How did... Yeah. What was that about?
Well, at the time, I was in between jobs and watching way too much daytime television. So I said to myself, I should read something. So I picked up his book. And early in that book, he said the tribute to black cooks is yet to be written. Now, I'm reading the book in around 2000. So it's several years after he wrote it. So I tracked him down on the internet. And I said, this is a really interesting statement. Do you still think this is true? And he said, yeah, for the most part, people have dealt with parts of it, namely Jessica B. Harris and some others, but no one's really taken on the whole subject. So with no qualifications except for eating the food a lot and cooking it sometimes, I said, I could do that. And that started me on the journey about just trying to researching what was out there. I reached out to some food writers and they said, look, you know, this country's racist, so this cuisine and its cooks has not been celebrated. But thanks to the digitization of old newspapers, magazines, and all the cookbooks out there, I found out, yeah, these cooks were celebrated. 100 years ago, African-American cooks were put on par at the same level as French cooks in terms of their reputation for cuisine and cooking.
So where did they begin to part ways?
Well, let's talk about how they come together. Okay. So what happened is a lot of wealthy families would have their enslaved cooks sent over to Europe to apprentice under a French chef so they could do that French cooking, because that was the cuisine of entertainment. So a lot of French techniques come into soul food via this training, this elite training that they got.
Can you give me an example of something that survives today that is a French influence in soul food cooking?
I think spoon bread is the perfect example, a cornbread souffle. I think that's the best example of kind of that. And then you see similar dishes in the rustic cooking. Like if you think of black-eyed peas with some ham hock in it, to me that's very similar to cassoulet. I mean, cassoulet is much more advanced and involved in that, but you could see kind of similar.
Yes,
but I think spoon bread
true.
Is the basic example. So we get to the late 1800s and early 1900s where you have people coming from other countries to the United States to sample our cuisine. And they're saying the cooking of African Americans, these black cooks, is on par with French chefs, which is an astounding statement. So I think where it started to part ways is when you saw the movement of these cooks from cooking in hotels and other things to kind of restaurant and home cooking. I think then our society kind of started to snub what those cooks were doing. And part of it was the advent of white chefs. As you saw the industry changing and embracing more and more whites cooking, the black chefs start to get denigrated.
Let's go back in time a little further to even before you read John Edgerton's book. How did the Black Power movement of the 1960s change the American view of soul food?
Yeah, so before that, soul food was called either Southern cooking or down-home cooking. So in the 1960s, you had a conscious effort to link the food with culture and identity. So that was the big story in the 1960s. Now, a lot of people think soul food was coined then as a term, but it actually has been in the English language for much longer. Mm-hmm. So when we fast forward to the 1960s, the Black Power movement advocates were saying, look, this is the food of our culture, our identity, and white people, you don't know what it is, and you can't even understand it or relate to it, which is news to white Southerners because they were used to eating a lot of the same foods.
Yeah.
So I think that's where we start to see this thing that African Americans in the South make soul food. White Southerners make Southern cooking. And I think that is the legacy of what we see today with no African Americans really strongly associated with Southern cooking, at least in media circles.
Well, do you ever come across anybody who hates it when that term is used?
Oh, yeah. There's still some people that don't like the term soul food, because even though in the 1960s it was all about creating a cohesive culture, it still was strongly associated with poverty and the master's leftovers. So there's a stigma to the food, and some don't want to be associated with that stigmatized cuisine. So I think that's why you see some African-American chefs who even may make these things not calling it soul food. In fact, one of the big trends right now is kind of upscale Southern. Mm-hmm. So they're taking these things, reframing them, repurposing whatever, putting it on a plate, charging you $20 and calling it Southern cooking.
Now, you talked about this connection to feeding the soul. What do you see as the true origin of that term soul food?
So to me, I think the true term is about the African-American experience. Born through poverty, born through oppression, just the realness of the African-American experience and the triumph over adversity. And so soul food plays off the tangible and the intangible. And I think that's a lot of the story with the duality that African-Americans have in this country. I mean, we're citizens of this country, but we're not fully citizens in this country. So we're almost like familiar strangers in that we don't enjoy the same rights as other people, and we're still striving for that equality. So I think soul food catches that tension.
Yes.
And that through all that we've been through as African Americans, in many ways we have the most honest expression of being American.
We'll have another serving of Adrian Miller's soul food coming up next. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. My guest today is Adrian Miller, author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine. As our conversation continues, Adrian reveals the West African origins of soul food and why the future of this distinctly American food might be in jeopardy.
There are several foods that originate in West Africa, namely black-eyed peas, where they're called cowpeas in English over there. To some extent, certain greens come from there, although a lot of the greens that we eat here are substitutes for those greens. And then also okra and watermelon. So when you think about West Africa, and I define West Africa as the band of countries from Senegal in the north to Angola on the south along the western coast of the African continent, there are several kind of what I call culinary carbohydrate zones, because the typical West African meal is a starch served with a stew, a sauce, or a soup, and that could be alongside the starch or on top. And so the starches are rice in the north area because they have their own indigenous rice. And then as you move down the coast, things like grains like millet, sorghum, black-eyed peas become important. And as you move further south, then you get to the root crops like yams, cassava, and other things. And you all will know this in Louisiana, but outside of Louisiana, I often have to explain that what we call a yam in this country is not the same as a tropical yam.
True.
And I explain why there's been identity theft, because what we call a yam here is really a dark flesh sweet potato.
Well, the identity theft, does that have anything to do with what you call the whitewashing of Southern soul food?
Oh, no, I think it's early on when the sweet potatoes were introduced into West Africa. They were called the white man's yam.
Okay.
And so I think that just is a carryover. I think it was confused from the day one, and that carried over.
Well, then what is the whitewashing of Southern soul food?
Yeah. The best example of this is the current day trend for nose-to-tail cooking.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, celebrating the animal, right? Cooking the whole animal. And so now you're seeing oxtails, pig's feet, pig ears show up on white tablecloth restaurants.
Necks.
Right.
All sorts of animal necks.
Right. And so now it's recast as the celebration of the animal and, again, getting charged a lot of money for it. The African-American contributions or roots or even the West African origin of these foods are obscured.
Yeah.
And so you just there's no connection, historical connection there. And I just think if we're going to take the time as chefs, I shouldn't say we because I'm not a chef, but if chefs are going to take the time to locally source their ingredients,
yeah,
they could give a little history too.
Amen, brother. Okay, so I'm very curious. When we go back to West Africa, why was the introduction of the chicken so important there?
Right. So the chickens arrived in West Africa at a really unique time. It was at a time when West African societies were starting to urbanize. And so you had these elites that were trying to bring people together, but also maintain their power. So you've got this funky looking animal that shows up.
And when is this?
So this is about 1000 AD, roughly.
And where'd it come from?
So the chickens were first domesticated in Southeast Asia from the jungle fowl. And so as the chickens make their way westward, they're celebrated for divine purposes because they're the only animal that announces the morning. They were often used to predict the outcome of battles. So the Romans, before a big fight, they would put some chickens out and see how they behaved, and that would be an omen for how the battle was going to turn out. And they were also known for entertainment, cockfighting, and other things. So you see these kind of parallel tracks, in addition to being food and other things. So when chickens show up, they have these folklore coming with them to West Africa. And so a lot of West African elites decided to use chickens as a symbol of power. Mm-hmm. So you start to see chickens showing up in art. You start to see chickens displacing the native fowl and sacrifices and other things. And you see chickens showing up as symbols of power. So much like we use the bald eagle to express American power, they were using chickens to do the same thing.
To do this research on this project, you spent a whole year, sounds like it was a really rough year, Adrian, really, traveling to and eating in 150 soul food restaurants in 35 different cities.
Yes.
What are your most memorable meals when you look back at that time?
So one was just because it was shocking. And this was at Willa Mae's Scotch House.
Yes.
I ordered my sides and they told me they were vegan. Yeah. But speaking of vegan, one of my most memorable meals was in a place called Solely Vegan in Oakland, California. So this is a vegan soul food place. I had southern fried tofu, vegan mac and cheese, vegan collard greens, and cayenne pepper lemonade. So the tofu...
Wow.
Yeah. So the tofu was shaped to look like fried chicken. And when I tasted it, I closed my eyes, it had the texture and taste of catfish.
Really?
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
The mac and cheese, they use soy milk instead of dairy products. And then the collard greens tasted like anything else you would have. But one of my favorite places was a place called Senator's Place in Cleveland, Mississippi. It's run by the family of a guy who's in the Mississippi State Legislature, and it was just basic meat and three, but it was just wonderful food. It was very cheap, and I learned a lot from that experience. I learned that lunch is still kind of the big meal in terms of going out to eat, mm-hmm. and that reflects the agricultural legacy of the area, right? You got up at dawn, worked hours, had that big meal, and then got you through the rest of the day. Now, when I went to the Senator's Place, there was a time of controversy because the buffet went from $6 to $8, and so people were really upset about that.
So as you traveled around to those 35 cities, what were the surprising things that you found out there on the road?
Well, one of the things, and it's kind of sad, is just the rate at which these soul food joints are closing.
Really?
Yeah. If I had taken my tour 5 years earlier, I think I would have written a different book, because a lot of the joints that have been around since the 40s would still be operating. But that's just really changed in the last few years.
Why do you think?
I think a few things are going on. First of all, just running a restaurant is tough business.
Yeah.
So with the economic decline in 2008, I think a lot of people got washed out there. I think the second thing is change in demographics. Mm-hmm. With the triumphs of the civil rights movement, African Americans could leave the neighborhoods that they were segregated in and live in other parts of the town. Yeah. And if you don't come back to the neighborhood and support that place, it's tough going. And then the third thing is, as the owners or the proprietors are ready to hand the business off to someone else, the kids are just not interested in doing it because of the stigmatization of being involved in the food service industry. Before, this was one of the few jobs that African Americans could do. Civil rights opened up a lot more opportunities.
It's just like black farming. You know, we need our farmers in America, and it's going to take some work to get black kids to come back to the farm.
Right. Now, there's some bright signs. I found in the Mississippi Delta area, there are efforts to get kids connected to agriculture, because a lot of kids have no idea where things come from. Like, they don't know French fries come from a potato.
No, they think it comes out of a package.
Right. Yeah. So there's efforts to reconnect people to the land.
Well, I am so tickled that I was able to track you down for an interview in person. I love talking to you, and let's do this again soon, okay?
All right. I'd like to break cornbread with you once again.
Amen.
I've enjoyed it.
Adrian Miller, author of Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. ¶¶ Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is always on the move, but considers New Orleans to be her heart's home. Because food is her passion, she's spent her life following what she calls the Okra Trail. By tracking the movement of okra as it traveled with the slave trade to the rest of the world, our hero became a leading authority on African food. From Benin to Brazil, our hero sought out the secrets of home cooks, learning and sharing those secrets with us all in her brilliant collection of books.
I found an article by Miss Manners, and she says, in Star Spangled Manners, a book that she wrote, she talks about the Southerners, and particularly the white Southerners, and says, and I'm quoting from her here, "Southerners were learning to practice African manners. It is not from the British that what came to be known as Southern graciousness was developed, with its open, easygoing style, its familial use of honorifics, and its y'all come to see us hospitality. The higher the Southern family's pretensions, the more likely the children were to be receiving daily etiquette instruction from someone whose strict sense of the fitting came from her own cultural background, the house slave."
Her books have taken us beyond gumbo and High on the Hog, two of her most popular titles. High on the Hog's invaluable content was recognized for its groundbreaking study of African-American food history and the cooks who created it, with an award by the International Association of Cooking Professionals.
It goes back to plantation humor, and actually there were a series of trickster tales that grew out of plantation humor and that had to do with the master and John, who would have been the enslaved person, so that at hog-killing time, Massa would come down to the cabins and say, "Come on, John, it's hog killing time. You're going to come and help me kill the hog, and I'm going to give you the head and the tail and the feet and the innards." And John said, "Yes, Massa." And that went on for years. And then one day John got his own hog. Then he got another hog. And that winter, when Massa came down to the quarters at hog killing time and said, "John, come on down, I've going to kill the hog," and John sort of said, "I don't rightly think so, Massa. I've got my own hog now, and I'm eating backbone and middling. I'm eating pork chops and bacon. I'm eating ham. I'm eating High on the Hog. Not the feet, but the ham."
That's why Dr. Jessica B. Harris is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. Thank you, Jessica, for unraveling so many culinary mysteries of the African continent and explaining their place on our Louisiana table. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Born ethnobotanist Dr. Mark Plotkin serves as president of the Amazon Conservation Team. Among his many honors and awards, in 1999, Time magazine hailed Dr. Plotkin as an environmental hero for the planet. His conservancy organization is leading the charge to save the Amazon, a step he believes is essential in saving our planet. Well, gosh, it's like having a superhero here. Welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thanks, Poppy. It's good to be home.
First, would you explain the work of an ethnobotanist?
An ethnobotanist, very simply, is a scientist who works with people and plants. Most of us tend to focus on indigenous peoples, and most of us tend to focus on medicinal plants. So I'm an Amazonian ethnobotanist. I'm working on medicinal plants of the rainforest with indigenous peoples, the medicine men and medicine women who know these forests far better than we do.
Well, I'd like to hear a little bit about your life's voyage from your boyhood home here in New Orleans to the jungles of the Amazon rainforest. So how did all of this happen for you?
Well, I'm an uptown boy, born and bred in Broadmoor. I went to school right nearby at Newman And people often ask me, how can you stand to work in the rainforest at your age? You know, it's hot, there's mosquitoes, there's corruption. And I said, hey, I grew up in Louisiana.
Feels like home.
Second nature. So I left Louisiana at the age of 18 to go to school in the Northeast. After a year at Penn, I dropped out and took a job as a gopher in a museum at Harvard. And I fell under the spell of a professor who'd gone to the Amazon in 1941 and went missing for 14 years. He is the world's, or was the world's, authority on the Amazon. And watching his pictures of nearly naked people doing bizarre dances under the effects of hallucinogenic drugs, I said, that's the path in which I want to follow.
That's what I want to do when I grow up. So how'd you do it?
Well, I went down to the Amazon and figured out how to do it. So I started young. As I often say, I'm educated at Harvard, Yale, Tufts, the Amazon, and the French Quarter. And
yeah,
all of those things.
That's a question I've got for
all
you.
All those things interrelate. Because I worked in my dad's shoe store on the weekends. This was the 60s in a cultural sense. It had real relevance. And the whole idea of people living differently, of having different ways of knowing, of having different ways of experiencing the world. And I think in some ways this was some of the seeds of the slow food movement, that people wanted to get away from consumerism, industrialization, more is better. And I think it speaks to both of us.
Yeah, it certainly does. Now, I'd like you to elaborate a little bit on the relation that you see between New Orleans and the tropics of the Amazon.
You know, a lot of New Orleanians forget that New Orleans used to be the capital of tropical America. Everybody sent their kids to Tulane. Before the building of the Miami airport, all the steamship traffic was through New Orleans. A lot of the country's coffee comes in through New Orleans. So there's a much stronger tie to the tropics than a lot of people understand. And, you know, one of the really bizarre good news stories post-Katrina is the re-Latinization of New Orleans. I mean, I remember going through Center City to take some pictures of some old jazz sites right after the hurricane, and there's all these Mexican guys walking through there. And I stopped and said to one in Spanish, what are you doing here? And he said, well, we're all from Oaxaca, and we're here to rebuild roofs. So when I was a kid growing up in the French Quarter, my dad's shoe store, there were a lot of Latins and a lot of Central Americans. And with this whole influx of Mexicans and Oaxacans, you see a Latin element of New Orleans, which had kind of gone missing the last couple of decades.
That's really fascinating. Mark, let's talk about Colombia's Chitipiquete National Park. It's really a huge step, its very creation, in conserving what's been described as the Sistine Chapel of the Amazon.
Chitipiquete National Park is the most sacred spot in all of Amazonia. Remember, most of us associate the Amazon with Brazil, but there's nine countries that harbor the Amazon forest. And we think of Colombia as a suburb of Brazil, but the Colombian Amazon is bigger than New England. It's a lot of rainforest. Chitipiquete is the site sacred to the Carijona Indians. It harbors probably as many as 500,000 indigenous paintings. That makes it the Sistine Chapel of the Amazon forest, the greatest collection of pre-Columbian art in the Western Hemisphere, as far as I know. There's all kind of weird stuff there. We just found a tree that's only known from Asia and Africa, a unique species, but from the family that's not supposed to be in the Amazon. And it was first discovered and explored by Hamilton Rice, 1907, a famous Harvard geographer. It was then scientifically described by my mentor, Richard Schultes, in 1943, and there's places that Schultes went and collected that have not been visited since.
Has the civil unrest in those very volatile countries affected your work at all?
Well, it has in several different ways, particularly in Colombia, where we focus very heavily. And the Civil War has kept a lot of bad guys out of Colombia. And I'm talking about bad guys, Chinese corporations, Canadian corporations, maybe even American corporations that might not have adhered to the letter of the law, or there wasn't much environmental legislation in place in the past, which there is now. With the Civil War dying back in Colombia, the Amazon is on the chopping block. And the question is it going to be protected and managed well, or is it going to be destroyed? The answer is not in yet, but we're very heavily involved.
What plants and animals populate this region?
You know, Poppy, what's particularly interesting and not realized by many of us here in New Orleans or the U.S. is how many of our crops come from the rainforest, come from the tropics. You know, if you have a typical breakfast of corn, Rice Krispies, coffee, tea, chocolate, hash brown potatoes, pineapple juice, orange juice, all of those things come from the rainforest. Okay, you look at a bowl of gumbo. Okras from tropical Africa, red peppers from the Amazon, black peppers from tropical Asia, rices from tropical Asia. Just because we pulled some of these things like rice or sugarcane out of the rainforest, it'll grow well in Louisiana. We can't write these forests off because every year we have to go and look for wild and semi-domesticated relatives to increase resistance to pests and diseases. But everybody who likes to eat well in New Orleans, which is everybody, has a stake in these rainforests if we want to keep that New Orleans cuisine on the table.
Now, not just the plants and animals, but the isolated indigenous peoples who live there are pretty fascinating, too. They're sometimes described as the lost tribes. So who are these mysterious bands of hunter-gatherers?
Well, we work with the Colombian government to enact legislation saying if uncontacted people are found from the air, because we don't want to contact them, they need to be protected. Their forest needs to be protected. And once this legislation was enforced, we pulled out our map and showed where the 14 uncontacted tribes were.
Oh, gosh. Well, explain the terrible dangers of the outside world contacting these tribes.
Well, death and extinction, which has been the case over and over again. These people don't have resistance to pests and diseases, just as we saw in Louisiana, just as we saw in California. We see in the Amazon that, you know, that has to be handled very, very carefully. And we don't have all the answers yet, so we think it's better to keep these people isolated unless they choose to come out. We're developing a contingency plan for health care in case they want to come out so that they don't all die in the process, which has been the historical record time and time again.
So if they want to come out of these isolated areas, they're inoculated and such?
That's the idea. We just had an uncontacted people in Peru come out of the rainforest, and the thinking was they came out because they had to, because their forest was being cut down by loggers and they wanted help.
Oh, gosh, what
so,
a tragedy.
You know, they don't come out looking for iPads and iPods. They're pretty happy when left alone, but these people weren't being left alone.
What are the practices and diets of these hunter-gatherers?
Protein, 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 and protein. They don't eat carbohydrates.
Really?
So it really is a Paleolithic diet. And it's only when people come into contact with all the blessings of the modern world that they get hooked on sugar, get hooked on salt, that can cause all the problems that we all know so well. So when you see these people, they're slender, they're muscled, they're healthy, they're happy, they don't suffer from stress-related heart disease, they don't suffer from acid reflux, they don't suffer from insomnia. So there was a great cartoon in The New Yorker a couple of months back where these explorers came up and said, here are iPads and iPods and cell phones, we'll be back in a month with antidepressants.
Oh, is that the truth? Well, what are these proteins? I mean, I imagine the whole area is just traced with rivers, so there must be a lot of fish that they eat. What else do they eat? What are their proteins?
It's meat and it's fish. The Xingu Indians that I've worked with in the Southeast Amazon in Brazil only eat fish. They do not hunt mammals. And so when you see the government damming the rivers, you know there's going to be a terrible price that's going to be paid by those indigenous peoples. Most rainforest indigenous peoples live off of terrestrial mammals and terrestrial fish, and most of them do have gardens, but these isolated, uncontacted groups, by and large, don't.
When we come back, we're going deeper into the hidden world of the Amazon as Mark Plotkin demystifies the magical medicine of the shamans. Don't go anywhere. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Although located thousands of miles away, the Amazon rainforests have an amazing impact on our local kitchens and medicine cabinets. We've been talking with Louisiana native ethnobotanist Dr. Mark Plotkin about the importance of the people, animals, and plants from the South American rainforest. Mark believes the cure to many modern diseases could be found in the medicine of the Amazonian shamans.
A shaman is simply what we would call a medicine man or a medicine woman. They use mostly plants for medical reasons, but we also are finding they're using insects, which have very powerful chemicals. And it's important to note that it's not just about protecting the rainforest, because it's the knowledge of the rainforest. It'd be like, you know, trying to do research in a library with no card catalog or no internet. So we need the peoples, their knowledge, their culture, and the plants to protect it if we're ever going to take advantage of this wisdom.
Well, in all your work down there, I imagine you've seen and learned some pretty fascinating things when it comes to what you've described as recipes for health. What are these recipes that you've seen in practice in the Amazon?
Well, in some ways, it's what your mother told you. You know, go out and get some exercise, be with your family, get a good night's sleep, eat well. These things which are basically common sense, but we just find it very hard to do them all because we're so busy and we're so hooked to our technology. But when you see these people that are happy and healthy and sometimes live past 100, with certainly no medicines that we take, I mean, they're taking the plant medicines, you realize there's lessons to be learned and there's a price to be paid when we live in a world where we're constantly under stress. We are evolved to chase animals on the savannas of East Africa or be chased by them and not sit in our air-conditioned comfort in front of a big screen TV 24/7. So when you see how well these people live and how simple they live, there are clearly lessons to be learned. And we've brought Native Americans from this country down to the Amazon, and we've brought Amazonian shamans up here so people can learn from each other.
I love that symbiotic relationship. So there seems to be a very fine balance here, though, because these peoples have this medical knowledge that the modern world can so benefit from. And yet, we really have to be careful, A, how much we actually take from them,
right,
and some of them even being in contact with them. How does this really work?
Well, my organization, the Amazon Conservation Team, is an environmental organization. We are not a drug development organization. We are a not-for-profit. And our job is to help these people protect their forest and their cultures, because with no rainforest, there's no rainforest Indians. And with no rainforest Indians, in most places, there's no rainforest. So it's a delicate balance, but it can be done. For example, one of the things I'm proudest of is we have worked with 32 tribes to map their lands. So we've got guys in penis strings with GPSs, and it's the perfect marriage of ancient shamanic wisdom and 21st century technology. Why should we wall them off and say, no, you can't have polio vaccine or you can't have GPSs? We can't. But you want to manage this contact with the modern world so it's not all about, Cheetos and crappy music and all this other stuff, because we know how powerful our culture is and we know it can swamp other cultures and wipe them out. If you go to Costa Rica, this sickly seduction is on every corner with Pizza Hut and KFC and everything else. If you go to Colombia, if you go to Bogota, the gringo tide hasn't overwhelmed culture to the same degree. I think there has to be a happy medium.
Mark, you believe that there is a direct correlation that we can find between the deforestation and loss of the Amazonian rainforest and the really serious situation we have here in Louisiana with our wetlands. Tell us about that.
Poppy, one of the things you learn when you work with shamanic cultures is the interconnectedness of all things. So a couple of years ago, I gave a keynote address at Tulane, a conference on, conservation in Louisiana. And, of course, the whole focus was on protecting and rebuilding the wetlands. And I got up and I said, congrats to Ollie for the great work you're doing. Now, here's the bad news. If the Amazon burns down and the polar ice caps melt and ocean levels rise, it won't make a damn bit of difference if you protect all those wetlands. So the point here is we can't just worry about, our own home, our own city, our own state. It's all connected. We need to think big picture. That doesn't mean you write off the wetlands at home, but it doesn't mean you write off the Amazon forest either.
And the bottom line here is no Amazon rainforest, no Bananas Foster.
Well, you can buy cultural real estate in Arkansas if this all this bad stuff happens. But if you look at Bananas Foster, made from bananas, which come from tropical Asia, cinnamon, which comes from tropical Asia, sugar, which comes from tropical Asia, vanilla, which comes from tropical Mexico, you take all the way, you're looking at an empty plate.
Well, we don't want that to happen. So, Mark, how can our listeners learn more about you and your work and contribute to your fund?
Well, the best way to learn more about our work is go to www.amazonteam.org. That's the Amazon Conservation webpage. I'm very easy to find on the web. There's lots of stuff. Just Google Mark Plotkin. And we need everybody's help.
And what are the names of your books?
Well, Tales of a Shaman's Apprentice is my first book, and that just rolled into the 30th printing. Medicine Quest, The Shaman's Apprentice with Lynn Cherry, that's my kid's book. The Killers Within, which only 7 people bought, and I think 2 of those copies were bought by my mother.
Oh, dear. Well, you know, all writers have that experience. Thank you so much, Mark. It was such a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Ethnobotanist Dr. Mark Plotkin on a mission to save our planet. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Dr. Mark Plotkin, virtually every delicious ingredient in New Orleans' famous Bananas Foster originated in the Amazonian rainforest. Bananas, sugarcane, rum made from that sugarcane, vanilla for the ice cream, and even cinnamon hails from that endangered region. I think it's time to cook up some Bananas Foster in tribute to Mark's amazing work there. The most important ingredient is what Brennan chef Lazone Randolph describes as the speckled banana. Those are the really ripe ones with all the brown spots. The sugars become so developed when a banana ripens to that stage, caramelizing them is a breeze. First, melt butter in a frying pan and stir in the brown sugar. Continue stirring until the graininess disappears from the brown sugar, then add the halved bananas. Brown on one side, then flip over and brown on the other. Now it's time for the flambé. Don't ever pour liquor straight from a bottle into a hot pan because the alcohol could ignite in the bottle and explode. So, to be safe, transfer that liquor into a separate container before pouring on top of the bubbling banana mixture. Tilt the pan slightly, and the flame will jump from the stovetop into the pan. Now it's time for the real pyrotechnics. While the rum is flaming, sprinkle on ground cinnamon. The cinnamon will spark, creating amazing fireworks. Then, simply serve the finished Bananas Foster over ice cream, and you'll have created a magical dessert memory. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website, louisianaeatsradio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker. And Bananas Foster is real Louisiana Eats.
Now I got the white gold, my baby got the tub. We gonna put them together, gonna rub, rub, rub. Then I'm telling you, baby, I sure ain't got a knife. Let me put my banana in your fruit basket, then I'll be satisfied.
Chef Ryan Hughes is our Louisiana Eats ingredient specialist. Ryan's back and ready to inspire us with some new tastes. So, Ryan, what are you serving up today?
What I brought for us today is, I think, straight out of the children's Dr. Seuss book.
It does look pretty Seussian.
It looks very Seussian, almost like a psychedelic hood ornament off a cactus. That's what I could call it.
So what is it?
Well, it's known under 2 different names. When it went across to the Asian communities in, say, Southeast Asia, whatnot, they called it, of course, dragon fruit. Sounds very intense.
It's kind of spiny, so I can see why they'd call it that.
How do I describe this to our listeners? It's red, almost like, ooh, this is a good descriptor. It's almost looks like a pomegranate. Is that correct? In color?
Except it's more fuchsia.
With these kind of spiny leaves coming off of it.
That are an alternate green color. It's quite colorful. And is it always about the size of a baseball?
Correct. And what it is dragon fruit, also better known in the Americas as pitaya.
So where did it come from originally?
It's native to Mexico and Central America.
And you know, it looks really hard, but when you squeeze it, it kind of feels like a Nerf ball.
Exactly. Why don't I cut it open for you and we can kind of check out and see what's inside of it. Surprise.
Wow.
How beautiful is that?
It's absolutely gorgeous inside. It's a deep maroon color with almost black ruby colored. Are those seeds?
That's correct, Poppy. Those are seeds. And what we're looking at now, there are three types of pitayas. Let's just call it pitaya for now. And this is pitaya rosada or roja. Obviously, roja meaning red.
Yeah.
And this is how new it is actually to me. I find it in the local Latin American markets here in New Orleans. And I've probably purchased it maybe about 10, 12 times. I use it in drinks.
Mm.
Exactly. Doesn't that sound delicious?
A cocktail ingredient. Like what would you mix it with? Rum? Tequila?
There you go. Rum. I take the pulp itself and I muddle it with sugar cane, add rum to it, a little bit of ginger and soda water, and look out. Take a cross-section slice of the pitaya, put a little wedge in it, and use it as a garnish for the top of there, and all your guests look like you've walked right out of the psychedelic library.
Well, it looks like a pretty pink drink, I bet.
And back to the color, there is the pitaya blanco, blanco meaning white. They look exactly the same on the outside. I'm sure maybe there's some listeners out there that can help us out and can get some feedback and actually help me out. But when you cut open it, literally it looks like dice, like that you roll, you know. So it's got like that white color, almost like a off-white to it with all the little black fleck seeds into it. And what I've done with that is I made a drink with that where I took the white flesh and actually cubed it like dice. And I set it in a drink so it actually looked like dice in a drink.
You have some creative thoughts. So are you cooking with it?
I don't cook with it, per se. I like the flavor how it is. It's just a lovely little thing. The third type of pitaya is pitaya amarillo. And it looks exactly the same on the outside, but you cut it open and it is a bright, bright yellow color on the inside. It's absolutely beautiful. The outside part is not good for you. Let's tell our listeners that. So let's not have any listeners licking and eating the outside of the pitaya.
Or taking a bite.
Or taking a bite like a great big apple. So it's more of a kiwi kind of light hint strawberry flavor. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely.
It
That's
does.
A really great description.
It's a good descriptor.
Well, Ryan, thank you so much for this incredible show and tell today. And all I can say now, I suppose, is cheers.
Salud.
Thanks. Chef Ryan Hughes of the New Orleans Pop-Up Purlieu, our Louisiana Eats culinary consultant. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and LCI Workers Comp. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh, consulting producer Margaret Howes, and sound engineer Guy Mulladew. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.